Well, good afternoon and welcome to Visions in Sound. My name is Rob Daniels. This week's show is a look at a composer whose name may not be familiar, but the music is some of the best I've heard in a long time. Martin Kishko has been working in the industry over 20 years, and his music is virtually unknown here in North America. Today, I'm hoping to change that. It is my great pleasure to present his music on today's program. I actually discovered Martin's music totally by accident. I was on musicfromthemovies.com and I read about a project that he was involved with called The Killing of John Lennon. I was intrigued and went to the film's main website. I sent an email asking if I could speak to either the director or the composer or both. A few days later, Martin contacted me and we set up an interview. I'm so glad that I spoke to Martin and hope that you'll enjoy his music of this fantastic composer that I knew virtually nothing about until just a few weeks ago. To get things started, though, I thought I'd play some of Martin's music from earlier in his career. This 1992 BBC documentary takes a look at the beautiful Russian wildlife and some of the Russian wilderness as well. Here is some of music from Realms of the Russian Bear. Thank you. Well, welcome back to Visions and Sound as we look at the scores of Martin Kishko. Before I get to the next score, here is a part one of the interview I did with Martin.
Well, let's start with what is your musical background?
Well, my father was a musician, albeit an amateur musician. Our family roots go way back into Poland's history, to the ancestral lands of Belarus. At time, you know, many years ago, that land was divided. Many times it's changed hands. Anyway, he, as a young boy, made balalaikas as he grew up in Belarus and was a musician playing with his brothers in a village band that went from village to village playing for weddings and parties and so on. Finally, when he joined the Polish army and went through World War II and was demobbed into the UK, met my mother and settled down and found that he had a young boy that he wanted to pass on his passion for music to. That really was my musical background, really from the age of, I suppose, as far back as I can remember, listening to my father playing piano, accordion and guitar and violin, and playing either songs, Russian and Polish folk songs, or playing music from during the war years. He was very much into tangos and waltzes and all the music that he'd grown up with and obviously danced to during and after the war. So I heard all that as a child, and he encouraged me to take up an instrument. And in those days, most children started off with the recorder at school, which I did with a wonderful West Indian teacher from the island of St. Kitts. And she gave me a real enthusiasm for music, and that coupled with my father's enthusiasm meant that I picked up the clarinet at the age of 8 or 9 and started music college at the age of 10. In fact, clarinet and tenor sax. In fact, the tenor sax was bigger than I was at that time.
So what was it that first inspired you to write film and TV music?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I have all these memories of, wonderful, wonderful TV series, and, both British and American series that used to be on TV when I was a boy. I mean, things that I used to watch, which maybe many of your listeners won't even know about, but programs using puppets like Fireball XL5, mm-hmm. and, of course, Stingray and Thunderbirds. Wonderful series like The Fugitive, The Outer Limits, Lost in Space. And the music always fascinated me. And my father bought me, I probably was only about 10 or 11, bought me one of the first portable reel-to-reels that you could get. It took kind of tiny 3-inch reel-to-reel tapes. And I used to create my own radio programs, radio dramas on this reel-to-reel, and put my own music and effects onto it. Of course, you couldn't mix anything. There's no mixer as such, but I just used to perform all the voices and add my own music and effects simultaneously using instruments or using boxes of nails to make the sound of somebody walking on gravel, that kind of thing.
Yes.
So I was absolutely fascinated with how you could put on an audio track onto some other thing, either onto a story or onto film. Leading on from that, I started orchestrating at the age of about 13 or 14, just for fun, actually. I had no idea what all the parts on the score would sound like, nor had I had any idea how to transpose them. But I used to take popular pop songs of the day, like, for instance, The Carpenter's Close to You, or I remember another one was Jethro Tull's The Witch's Promise.
Mm-hmm.
And I just used to play like any kid, really. Let me see if I can orchestrate this pop song for, 10 trumpets and a string section. And it was completely wild, and I never heard it played, and I'm sure it would have sounded abysmal, but there we are.
So how did you come to work on the film The Killing of John Lennon?
Okay, well, I suppose 200 film and TV scores later and the 7 albums and so on, which has, in a sense, I suppose, polished my trade and I guess has set me in good stead for approaching this kind of movie, because when Andrew Piddington approached me with the score, we had a very, very tight deadline. So I felt that I needed to call on all the experience you know, former scores, former years, to tackle it. And it came about because I met the team, Andrew Piddington and Raka Singh, the producer, in Cannes at the film festival a few years ago. They told me about this wonderful movie that they were making that was kind of 4 years in the making. You know, said, would I come and look at it next time I was in London? And I said, yeah, sure. And I went to see it. And they had a temporary track on there, and they wanted very much to replace that track. And once funding came in, they rang me up and said, look, we've got this very short period of time. You know, what do you think? You know, can you do it? Can it be done? And I said, well, yeah, I'm sure it can. But the challenge, the added challenge with it was that Andrew comes from a background of professional sound design.
Oh, yes.
He did an extraordinary, extraordinary impressionistic track with the sound design, and every single effect that he placed in was at a particular pitch. So it had, often it had an incoming pitch and an outgoing pitch, and of course when the music came in after those effects, he wanted the incoming pitch of the music or the outgoing pitch to match the entrances and exits pitch-wise of the effects.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just a simple grab hold of the narrative and, you know, check all the entrances and exits and all that kind of thing. It was actually, you know, working very, very closely to how the sound design was pitched as well.
So what was it that appealed to you about this film? You said that you had actually seen it beforehand.
Yeah, I think what really interested me is of course, you know, this is a film about a killer, you know, with a psychological problem. And of course, when we think about that, we think, well, okay, well, how can one make a movie out of that? Because, of course, you're making a movie out of someone that we know is bad, is evil. Of course, if one continues throughout the whole of the film just telling that story of evil, then it makes for a bit of a boring film. What one has to do is to instill some sense of humanity into the film as well. And I think that's what I saw, you know, in Andrew's film, that he was not only telling, you know, a story of Chapman and the evil thing that he did, but he's also trying to, you know, look for the motives, look for the psychological mindset. It's a very kind of detailed investigation of that mindset. And I think very important to us all, you know, as human beings, we all have the capacity in us to be evil, for us to commit awful crimes. We know that because that's unfortunately the nature of some of the parts of the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting for me as a composer, therefore, is, you know, how do you deal with that kind of music for that kind of character arc? On the one hand, you have to, you know, emotionally convince the audience that, you know, this is very serious and this is bad. But on the other hand, you have to instill some sense of humanity in there as well, that the fact is that you are still dealing with a character who is a human being. And that, for me, was important because it meant that I would have to develop some kind of thematic material, thematic motif that might be able to create that sense of humanity amidst, you know, something that was potentially evil and horrifying to deal with.
Okay. So now, how involved did Andrew Piddington become in your music, or were you just told, you know, go compose this and come back when you're done?
No, very, very involved. I mean, Andrew is extremely meticulous, has got a very, very acute ear. He came down, I composed and realized the score in Bristol, where I live. I normally would do it in London, but because of the time scale that we had, I did it all here in Bristol. Andrew came down from London most days and would listen very, very carefully, as I say, to the cues, both in relationship to the narrative and the vocabulary of the language of the film, but also, as I said, you know, in relationship to the sound design. The other thing is that he wanted a very, very subtle approach to the score. He didn't want to point up, you know, for instance, when we get to the point of Lennon's horrific murder, he didn't want to, you know, dramatically point that up in any way that actually glorified it in any way or gave it any particular dramatic impact. So he was very, very sensitive to how he wanted the what he wanted for the role of the music.
Okay, so did you approach this any differently because it was an actual event as opposed to something that was fictionalized?
Well, that's an interesting question. No, I don't think I did. I think that essentially what I wanted to do was I wanted to create, you know, I had all these signposts that Andrew, the director, had put into place that obviously I had to adhere to. I felt that my main role was to create a connectivity between the scenes, to try and create a journey musically from where the film starts in Hawaii to where it ends in New York. My job really was to develop a kind of very subtle development of the material across the film. As I say, without this, I found difficult in a sense, without pointing up over dramatically the events that happened in the film. So I tried to stay. Yeah, I definitely tried to stay clear of it being an event-led piece, but I don't think I tackled it any differently than I would have tackled any other fictionalized account or fictionalized narrative. Mm-hmm.
So you didn't style the music, let's say, in like late 70s, 1980s kind of music. You just kind of
no, okay. not in the slightest, and I think that's why. I mean. I think that's why the score is probably working as well as we can expect. You know, a lot of people have said to me, "Oh, you must have written a Beatles score then, or how did you write songs that were similar to the Beatles, or how did you come up with the type of music that was around at the time?" Well, the answer is that's exactly what we didn't want to do. The main thing, as I say, was to create this very, very subtle arc connectivity across the film, which also gives a sense of not only this is a horrific event that we're dealing with narratively, but also it as I said before, it's something that one has to bring some sort of level of humanity into as well.
Here is some of Martin's music from a fascinating documentary on insects called Alien Empire.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Visions and Sound as we look at the scores of the composer Martin Kishko. Now, if you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. You can also try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. You can find us on Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946, also if you have that option. Next up is a BBC documentary from 1999. This simply is called Battle of the Sexes in the Animal World.
Thank you.
Before we get to the final two scores by Martin, here is part two of the interview I did with him.
So now you've done a fair bit of work in TV as well as film.
Yeah.
What do you find is the main difference between composing for for TV as opposed to film?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the first few big TV series that I did. I mean, my big debut was back in 1985 with a series called The Strozzi Romance, which was a four-part surreal drama based on a novel by Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote that score, a lot of people said, and a lot of the press reviews said, you know, what is this guy doing here? He's a film composer in a television composer's body. And I always felt like that. I always felt that I favoured the epic gesture, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when writing on manuscript, I always was ambitiously large. So when I composed for a natural history series for the BBC Alien Empire in 1995 and released the album with the Munich Symphony Orchestra shortly after that, I based the orchestration there on the score that was Hitchcock's rejected score for Torn Curtains.
Ah, yes.
Where, you know, where he had something like 12 flutes and, you know, whatever it was, 40 strings and 16 horns or whatever. So when Hitchcock came into the studio, you know, and Herman was waiting there with that kind of setup, you know, Hitchcock saying, "Well, that's fine, but where's my theme coming from?" I thought, well, that would be an interesting way of approaching the particular thing I was doing. So again, I took that template and came up with a very, very large gesture again in terms of orchestral palette for the score. So it's been, you know, the Lennon movie for me has been a long time coming. I've had opportunities in the past with, you know, hoping that I would be able to do the kind of scores I did for Alien Empire or the Strozzi for the cinema, but it just wasn't to be. So this is the moment, and ironically, it's not that kind of score. It's a much more subtle approach, and it is largely an electronically sampled score with a chamber ensemble overdub. So it's not the usual epic symphonic palette that, you know, I'm happy to compose.
Mm-hmm. So now, do you find that you fashion your scores differently due to the technology that's advanced over the past couple of years since you started? Your music is heard now on much more better system than it did when you first. And do you find that you fashion your music differently because of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely the case with the electronically sampled material. And, of course, samples are changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Except I have to say that I've done a lot in my career with recording my own samples. I was one of the first composers in the UK, for instance, to, you know, go abroad. And this was on a series called Realms of the Russian Bear. I went to Russia and recorded instruments from all the former Soviet republics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, created a score that was very, very topical, very timely, very original, because the samples were, you know, that was 1995. And the interesting thing is, if I were to write that score again, those samples probably are not dated at all, you know, whereas if I'd be writing with samples from extant libraries of samples, then of course I would be having to continually steer a score to what the current standard of library sample is. So I think, yeah, I mean, interesting in that respect that, you know, I think if one is able to collect one's own source material, almost like using the orchestra, that it's timeless, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you hear an orchestral score, it's timeless, whether it was written, you know, 20 years ago or whether it's written now. In terms of an electronic sample score, I feel likewise that, you know, if I've recorded my own samples, my own, say, indigenous samples, those are still as lively, as real, as authentic as they were 10 years ago. But I think, as you said at the beginning, the use of library samples, for instance, one's continually having to adapt and refashion the material to suit. But then again, I found with the Lennon score, you know, that for me, because I'm so used to working with an orchestral palette, that I'm still hearing, you know, even in the most sophisticated samples, I'm still hearing that the envelopes of the samples, the attack portions of the samples, you know, just not quite what I'd expect to hear, you know, in a live orchestral setting. So my preference will always be to use a live orchestra.
All right. Well, now, as a composer, your job is, of course, to write music. But do you also use silence as a composing tool?
I think that's, you know, that's important. I always say when I've had students or younger composers that are interested in talking about film music, I've always said the most important thing that the composer is good at, and what I believe that they're paid, you know, their worth for, is to decide when the music should start and when the music should stop in a cue. It's absolutely critical, and therefore, you know, silence plays its place there. Silence is also important in the sense of music, is that there's a sense of punctuation silence gives. So, for instance, you know, the music might be covering, let's say, the way an actor moves, decide that a suitable piece of punctuation is the music stops at that point to allow us just to focus on who is going to enter the door before perhaps the music either anticipates who that person might be, actually synchronizes with the entrance of that person. So that silence that you created there, just in that example of the cue, is an absolutely essential piece of punctuation, just as if we're talking and we're punctuating our conversation with silence or commas or an exclamation. I believe that the film score should work with the narrative in exactly that punctuated manner. Another example of the way music can work in that way is I remember scoring a period drama where there's one point in the film where the boy kisses a girl. I had to decide where to start the cue, you know, whether to leave some silence just before the kiss came or whether to start on the kiss and then end the music shortly afterwards and leave some silence there. And it's all this element of anticipation or hitting the actual sync event or commenting on what has gone. So, of course, if you start the music early, you're anticipating, you're telling your audience, these people are going to be very much in love. If you're going to hit the actual hit point on the kiss, then you're saying, well, yes, that's it, I'm doing in the music what is actually happening in the film. If you're coming in after the music, if you've got silence and you allow the kiss to happen and then you bring the music in, then obviously you're starting to comment on the visuals or on the narrative dialogue. As I said in my earlier example, the punctuation in terms of the music's entrance and exit and the silences in between are absolutely critical.
So how would a score that you write today differ from one you wrote back in, let's say, 1985?
It would be much simpler.
Ah.
It would be, I mean, I love material which is highly textured and highly intricate in terms of its melodic motifs, its melodic themes, and its counter-melodic material. I love the interplay, the contrapuntal interplay of parts. But I found in a lot of my scores of the 80s and early 90s, some directors and producers didn't quite appreciate that. And I can see that, you know, for some of those directors, the music could have been too busy, too intricate, could have distracted perhaps from a dialogue or voiceover commentary. So I think one of the things that I've learned, and I learned this especially with Alien Empire in 1995, which is predominantly a minimalist score, but a minimalist score with I think much more melodic interest than you would normally expect from a minimalist approach to film scoring. That's how it would differ. It would be less heavy textually with the pen on manuscript, and it would be less intricate in terms of the use of counter melodic material. I would generally now tend to stick with one theme which develops very simply for the audience's ear.
So now, The Killing of John Lennon has been hitting the festival circuit, but it hasn't. I haven't seen it over here yet. I'm curious, are you planning on sort of touring with it, or...
I'd love to tour with it. I need a break. So if anybody would like to invite me, I'm very happy to tour with it. It's just actually been screening at Cannes this weekend at the festival, and I think has had some extraordinarily good reviews and responses. It plans to open in the UK on July the 27th, and I think the production company Picture Players, I believe that they're probably discussing North American deals and the potential for North American release as we speak. So I've no idea what their dates are, but I'm sure you're going to see it over there, sometime this summer.
Okay. So what does the future hold for you?
I'm embarking on a project which I've been wanting to develop for many years now, which is an opera.
Oh, yes.
So I'm hoping to write an opera for film on the life of Charles Darwin. And I've been working for about a year on that. That really is something I'll be working on and off for about the next 2 years. In addition to that, obviously, I'm hoping that some other feature product comes my way.
Well, thanks for your time today.
Well, it's a privilege being asked to speak to you, and I've really enjoyed it, and I hope that some little pearl that is useful in there.
Welcome back to Visions and Sound as we present scores from Martin Kishko. Here is some of Martin's score from the 1997 X-File-ish British series called The Uninvited.
Thank you. Thank you.
Last up is a score to a film that has yet to be seen here in North America. The Killing of John Lennon is a look at the grisly murder of music's greatest icon from the perspective of the assassin, Mark David Chapman. Martin has graciously allowed me to play some of his music from the show. This film has been delayed until October, and I'll be doing a special on the film and music when it comes out. So here's a little bit of music from The Killing of John Lennon by composer Martin Kishko. Well, that's all for me this week. I hope you've enjoyed this look at some of the scores of Martin Kishko. I'll end off this week's program with some more music from The Killing of John Lennon. I'll be back next week with more Visions and Sound.